Welcome to the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Maison Beljanski, providing natural supplements for helping your body's healing and wellness, inspired by over 40 years of groundbreaking research. Today we are talking with Jenny Powers, who's a PhD in immunology. Jenny, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
So you wrote a book recently called On the Origin of Being, Understanding the Science of Evolution to Enhance Your Quality of Life.
Yes.
Excited to kind of dive into that and what that's all about. But you also were a collegiate basketball player, is that right?
I was, yes, at the University of Colorado in the 90s. So it was a long, long time ago. But that was a really interesting experience. We were pretty good. But unfortunately, I just had so many knee problems. I've had 7 knee surgeries.
Oh my gosh.
So I don't play basketball anymore. But I did just start doing taekwondo because that's what my kids do.
That's so much better for the knees, right?
It actually really is.
Is there really?
I mean, I haven't gotten to a lot of the jumping and pounding, and I can't do jumping jacks. But it's really nice because I feel like an athlete again. I feel like I'm embodying my body in a way that I haven't really since, you know, I was playing competitive sports. So I'm really happy to have found that.
That's awesome. Yeah. Anything that you can do to be athletic, you know, that's one of the things that I'm trying to encourage people to realize, no matter your age, right? 40, 50, 60, 70, doesn't matter. If you think of yourself like an athlete, even if you're just walking around the block every day, or you're playing golf on the weekends, or you're doing taekwondo, or you're playing basketball with friends once in a while, like if you think of yourself like an athlete, you will take better care of your health, right? Athlete,
oh, totally.
You were a collegiate athlete and you probably thought a lot about recovery, sleep, nutrition.
Actually, I mean, not really. We weren't really taught that in, you know, early 90s. I wish I could go back and go through that experience now with knowing people having a focus on mental health and all of this, you know, how to fuel your body right, how to recover right. I mean, I feel like there really wasn't a whole lot of direction back then, other than weekly weigh-ins, which were not healthy either.
Right.
So, and you know, we took care of our bodies in terms of, you know, making sure we didn't injure ourselves, working up to things. We did have rest and recovery days. But I wish I knew then what I knew now about nutrition, because I turned 50 next year. And what I've learned through writing this book and putting some things into practice is that I feel better now than I've almost ever felt in my life. And I felt like I could go back and be an athlete, and I could go and, you know, just kind of, you're right, age is not a number, you know, and knowing that as you get older, I started lifting weights because that's really important. Taekwondo is flexibility, it's balance, and it's also just like control and it's a very like intellectually stimulating activity as well. And it just feels so good to push myself beyond, like for an hour and a half, I'm literally breathing hard and sweating for the entire hour and a half. And it just feels so amazing afterwards.
That's awesome. So, yeah, you bring up a good point that actually in the 90s, even I would probably say early 2000s, it's not more until recently that younger people are being educated on the importance of the things I spoke about. I guess what I should have said is, elite athletes, right? If you're at a professional level, like now you can eat terrible and you can miss out on sleep and you can not do as much recovery as an athlete when you're younger and get away with it to a certain
very
degree,
true,
right? In
very
your 20s,
true.
You know, mid-20s, early 20s. Once you start getting past 20s into 30s, it's like that becomes, you know, look at LeBron James, right? He's been playing basketball for 21 years.
It's amazing.
And
in the
only
NBA.
Way in the NBA, in the NBA, right? Professional basketball for 21 years, not playing basketball. He's been playing basketball his whole life. He's 38 now, I think. He's almost 40 years old. And the only way he's had that longevity is because of all the things we're talking about. So elite athletes, right, are really focused on nutrition. They have Nutrition coaches, right? They have physical therapists, they have massage therapists. I mean, many of them spend millions of dollars on their recovery, on their nutrition, on their training, on all this stuff to take care of their body. So when you are at an elite level of being an athlete, you have to take better care of yourself because you're tearing down your body so often. Well, if we adopt that same mindset when we're not elite athletes, right? We adopt the mindset of, hey, I'm going to take better care of myself so I can do this thing I enjoy doing longer and without so much pain and without as many injuries, and I can have more fun playing basketball, doing taekwondo, whatever it is we want to do. Then we're going to enjoy those things longer, but more importantly, we're going to be healthier as people.
Exactly. Well, and I also think, I mean, not just for like younger athletes are learning the importance of these things for their athletic careers, but I think, you know, that the evidence is coming out, like a lot of diseases that you get when you know, in your 50s and 60s are completely preventable.
Yes.
And certain symptoms and things that you're doing in your 20s and 30s are actually, you know, the seeds of some of those diseases. And so I think people who think like, oh, I'm invincible, and then and once I stop feeling invincible, then I'll take care of my body. Well, your body can recover incredibly. I mean, we're built to return to homeostasis, we're built to heal. But I want there to be more education about, you know, there's so many diseases nowadays, these diseases of modernity, you know, the non-communicable ones, you know, obesity and type 2 diabetes. And a lot of people have kind of normalized the fact that, oh, when you get older, these are just things you're going to have to deal with. We just have to deal with these things. And in reality, no, we don't. This is
Right.
not an inevitable part of aging. It is an inevitable part of our lifestyle,
Yes.
which has changed. And that's kind of the main point of our book, is that while we've pretty much, you know, since our world started changing radically with the agricultural revolution and then the industrial revolution and now the information age, our world has changed, like our environment surroundings has changed so much, and our behaviors have changed so much that we're no longer providing our bodies with their evolved biological needs, because our bodies have pretty much stayed the same and our lifestyles have changed. So there's this mismatch between what we're doing to our bodies and with our bodies and what our bodies actually need. And that mismatch hypothesis, you know, is thought to be, you know, a big underlying factor behind all of these diseases that we never used to get.
Right.
It's not an inevitable part of aging, you know? So
Yeah,
I think more and more people.
what people don't
Go ahead.
realize is that heart disease, cancer, diabetes, right? These are diseases of excess and deficiency. And these were very rare diseases even 100 years ago. Go back
Exactly.
100 years and look at the statistics for cancer. It was believed to be less than 1%. Go back 50 years, 60, 70 years, and it was only 5%, 10%. I mean, now it's almost 50% of people, right? And we're not talking about going back that far either. Like 100 years in the
Right, I know.
human time span is such a small amount of time, but all the thousands and thousands and thousands of years up to that point, these diseases were most likely unbelievably rare. And we know that also because they were doing autopsies even in the Roman times, even 2,000 years ago, for example, and rarely seeing things like tumors and cancers, that sort of stuff. It was a very rare thing to find. Now, everybody knows somebody who has cancer, if not yourself, who's listening to this, right? And there's a very important study published in Nature, and there's a lot of other corroborating studies that back this up as well, that says upwards of 95% of all cancer is caused by diet and lifestyle. That's so empowering because that's in our control. Our diet and our life, majority of our lifestyle, not all of it, but majority of our lifestyle is in our control, right? Choosing to sleep, reducing stress, cleaning up toxins out of our environment the best we can. Like we have quite a bit of control on that, not total control if we're going to live in this current, modern society. If you're not going to go be a monk up in the mountain somewhere, which even
I
then
know.
they're finding glyphosate, in mountains that are like hundreds of miles away from civilization, so you're still going to have some exposure. But most of it's in your control, what you put in your mouth, what you put in your mind, how you take care of your body. And that's the empowering thing, is the problem is most people don't realize what to do about it.
Have you heard of PEMF therapy for cancer? Well, this podcast is brought to you by Dr. Pollock, and he wants to share with you the groundbreaking research of pulsed electromagnetic field therapy in the treatment of cancer. Studies show PEMF therapy can help control the cancer process and give safe, non-toxic, and non-invasive symptom management. PEMF therapy may enhance other cancer support and treatments, lower inflammation, and promote tissue healing. Studies show it's possible to improve your general well-being and recuperate from surgery, radiation, and chemo better and more quickly. Embrace a comprehensive approach to cancer treatment with PEMF therapy, a vital tool on your path to prevention, treatment, and recovery. For caring and professional guidance and recommendations from Dr. Pollock, go to drpollock.com/intro to cancer. That's drpawluk.com/intro to cancer.
Well, and it's also, it's hard because, you know, people who are choosing to live a healthier lifestyle are going against the current of modern America or modern society. You know, there's not a whole lot of, I mean, there are more and more people you can surround yourself with who start to feel the same way. And, but there's this big juggernaut of modern society that's like pushing us down this path. And it is hard to swim back upstream, swim back to where we used to be. But hopefully, you know, the more and more people who listen to this message and who make those choices, even though it's hard, the more people will be like, oh, well, look at what they're doing over there. You know, you can live by example. And hopefully more and more people will get on board.
So what's the main big idea behind your book on the origin of being?
Yeah. Well, you know, we spent probably, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years living as hunter-gatherers in our human lineage. And that was a very adaptive way of life. And it also allowed us to, our evolutionary adaptations were supported by our lifestyle changes that we made in terms of our diet, in terms of how we walked, how we moved, how big our brains got. And so, you know, we really wanted to give people, you know, we like to kind of tongue in cheek say this is a scientific self-help book, because we didn't rely on trying to interpret other lifestyles, or we didn't rely on our own personal experiences, like this is how I did it. We really wanted the science of evolution, this historical knowledge of, you know, maybe from even the beginnings of life in some cases, all the way through to today. There's this continuum of how our bodies, how our behaviors are meant to be. And so the book really tries, this one particular book focuses a lot on that mismatch hypothesis. And then we talk about four different parts. And we like to think of these as kind of our basic needs: sleep, nutrition, how we work and rest, and our interactions with nature. And so we spend, each part goes, you know, we'd have our evolutionary history. We talk about how hunter-gatherers, how those behaviors express themselves in hunter-gatherers. And then we talk about modern behaviors. And by the time we get to modern behaviors, I think hopefully it's pretty obvious to people how far we've really strayed off how what our bodies really need. And then we have a, you know, we end each part with a chapter, like how can we bring, you know, we don't want to go back and live as hunter-gatherers. The modern world is amazing, but it's a double-edged sword. But humans are very, intelligent and creative, and we can make adaptations just by changing our behavior. So if we can learn some of the behaviors in the past and figure out how to bring them into the present and adapt them into the modern world, we hope to leave each chapter with some like really simple actionable items that people can use going forward.
Yeah, that's a good approach, I think, because there's a push in a certain amount of people to kind of romanticize our ancestors' way of living, mm-hmm. to a degree that's not practical today. And
it's
also,
not
I think,
practical. Well, and it's also not necessarily true.
And it's also not necessarily healthy in some ways, right? Like that's right. Just because the idea that I believe is that just because our ancestors did something doesn't necessarily mean that's what we should be doing. You know, like that's the first big idea that I think is, from my perspective, is important to realize that many things our ancestors did, we could learn from and adopt today and implement and see improvements in our life. And other things they did, probably we shouldn't be doing, and it's good that we're not doing them.
Right. We've evolved, we're past that. We've come past that. Yeah. And so we talk a little bit more. This is actually the first book in a trilogy, a series. So the next, you know, each subsequent book kind of goes up the complexity ladder, I guess. So like the next book that we just started working on is going to talk about social groups, the need for community, how child rearing has changed, and also the relationship between the sexes has changed. And so that's kind of like social needs, our social needs. And then the last book will cover even more complex ideas like the arts and religion and rituals and ceremonies and things like that. So those are kind of our cultural needs as human beings. So we were hoping as people kind of read their way through this book, they can kind of build on, and not everything is going to work for everybody. You know, people have to try things on themselves, and if they don't work, they don't have to keep going, you know, try something new. I feel so many times in, you know, our modern health and wellness culture, people get so fixated on like, this is the only way we can eat. This is the only way we should do this. And every human is so different that what works for one person is not going to work for another person. So, you know, saying, oh, well, I can't eat that because I'm a carnivore. Well, you know, we have someone over here saying, well, you shouldn't eat meat because we're, you know, vegans. And then there's someone, you know, people everywhere in between. And the answer to that is, well, yeah, because when we lived as hunter-gatherers, we lived in the Arctic. We ate mostly animals, like 5% plants. And then we lived in the tropics where we ate mostly plants, maybe only 15, 20% animal products. And then there's everywhere in between. And so what humans are omnivorous and we're adaptable, but we're also, you know, we are all different. Our genetic needs are different. I think this really cool nutrigenomics is kind of coming along to kind of see, well, what foods, you know, where's my ancestry and what foods did they eat? And maybe those foods are actually going to be what I need to support my nutrition. And so I really feel like, you know, just like medicine, functional medicine, everyone has to have an individualized curriculum pretty much because everybody's bodies are different. And so I feel that way about nutrition. Because, you know, we're all pretty genetically similar, but we are all very different. And that's what makes, you know, humans so interesting.
Yeah, I agree with quite a bit of what you said. And the part that I would kind of challenge you on a little bit is that idea, I like challenging people on this idea that the idea that we are so different from each other. That's very clear in personalities. That's very clear in spiritual beliefs. That's very clear in, you know, ways of being and so forth. But as you said, genetically, we're almost identical, right? Mm-hmm. If you compare an elephant to an elephant to an elephant to an elephant across all the different types of elephants, even though they're slightly genetically different, and every one of them has a different personality, they're all basically the same kind of animal, and they all basically eat the exact same diet. Right. That's true for gorillas. That's true for rhinos. That's true for every animal on the planet. The thing that I think has gotten in the way for us is our minds and our egos thinking that I'm so unique, I'm so special, I have to be so different. Right. And that ego, that identity then gets in our way and makes us have to, you know, do all these unique different things to try and be special, try to be recognized, try to fit into the hierarchy, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And, oh, I need to be liked, I need to be different, I need to be special, I need to have purpose and all these things. When in reality, you know, life to me is so much more simple than that. It's very, like, if we talk about diet is actually so simple. When you really boil it down to like the base principles, like if you follow basic principles of diet, you're gonna be fine in most cases, which is
exactly
eat real foods, avoid
whole
processed
foods.
foods, you know, eat plenty of plant foods in your diet, you know, eat organic, avoid, chemically infused foods and pesticide foods and all these things. Like, there's really basic principles, but then we try to complicate it. We try to be special and unique. We try to, I've got the new answer to the diet. No, I do. No, no, it's carnivore. No, it's this, no, it's that. And it's like,
no, that's exactly, I mean, and I think what I like to say, and I read this somewhere on the internet, I can't take credit for it, but so there's all this, you know, people are going to die on this hill, this dietary hill. And they're all, it makes it really confusing for people. But every single one of those diet gurus can agree on exactly what you said,
right,
what not to eat. If we can all agree on what not to eat, then it's pretty easy because what's left over is what you said, whole foods.
Right.
You know, our ancestors ate animals, you know, tip nose to tail. You know, they ate organ meat, they ate connective tissue. When we ate plants, you know, we had to, you know, we learned how to process plants and kind of get rid of their toxins by cooking or soaking or fermenting. But we ate the skins and we ate the seeds and we ate everything in between. So we were provided with not only the macronutrients, you know, carbs, fats, proteins, but also a wealth of our micronutrients, these vitamins and minerals and fiber and things that, you know, the modern world actually takes whole foods and it strips out all of these things to make food products. And then 90% of what is in the grocery store is made out of these food products stuck together in different ways.
Right.
But it's, we've totally taken out the really, you know, the important stuff. It's not just about calories. It's about all of the stuff that a whole food brings to you.
Exactly. Yeah. What would you say? Well, a couple questions. Before I forget, did you study at all kind of the Blue Zone communities and in your research?
No, it's actually something relatively new that I've come across. But it's really interesting to kind of now look back and compare what the Blue Zone people are doing and how they really do actually live a lot more like our ancestors, you know, that especially in terms of their movement, they're not sedentary.
Right.
And that is that's a huge piece as well.
Yeah.
Not only do they eat whole foods, but they grow their own foods. They're gardening, they're walking, they're sharing their community. It's not just about what they eat. It's their entire lifestyle that really does. It doesn't mimic how we used to live, but they've really done a good job of taking the things that our bodies need and adapting it to a more modern world. You know, I think that our ancestors, we weren't built for sitting. We're not built for looking at and doing the same thing for 8 hours a day. You know, we squatted, we lifted, we walked, we ran, we dug, we hunted, and we were never doing one thing for 8 hours a day in one position.
Right.
And so I really feel like that almost as much as nutrition, being able to integrate that kind of movement and variety back into our daily lives is really important too.
Yeah, I did a peyote ceremony once with these Native American elders years ago in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we did in a teepee, a very traditional ceremony. And this is basically this particular group of elders was, this was like their church. This was part of their spiritual practice. And these men were easily in their 60s, and they had the energy and youth and vitality and movement ability of somebody who was 15 years old. I mean, I had trouble sitting on the floor because you go in at sunset and you go all that, you do the ceremony all the way through the night, and then you come out at sunrise. And, you know, I hadn't been sitting cross-legged for more than 20 minutes at any time on the floor. And you sit on the ground, you know, for all night long. So whatever that was from sunrise to sunset, that's almost 12 hours, I think. I don't remember. I think it was in the winter when I did it there. And these guys would be sitting and then jump up, run around, do stuff, and sit back down, cross-legged, and they sit for an hour or something, and then jump up and run around. I'm sitting there, I'm just like, I'm in so much pain and my knees are hurting and my back and hips and all this stuff. I'm trying to get comfortable. I can't get comfortable the whole time. And they're just like, if even if I try to stand up, it's like everything's aching and hurting. And these guys are just like, boop,
Creaking.
boop, boop, boop. Yeah, like 15-year-old kids, like,
Wow.
in their 60s, just because they've been doing that their whole life, right? Because of that exact thing of movement, simple, basic human movements, not getting, not starting to bring in, keeping those indigenous practices, cultural practices of sitting on the floor, right? Sitting on the ground, not starting to bring in chairs to sit on, right? I mean, those simple things actually make such a huge difference in how well we feel, in our quality of life, in our movement abilities. Those are some of the, ancestral cultural ways of being that I think are wonderful things we could adopt today, right? Is
Yeah,
just
totally.
moving more naturally, sitting on the floor more often, sitting cross-legged, getting out of chairs, gardening, moving
Squatting.
our bodies, squatting, these things that
Yeah.
are so good for us, and yet out of convenience and comfort, we've gotten away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I want to come back to that whole convenience and comfort thing. But I wanted to ask you, when you were doing that ceremony, you were talking about the discomfort of your body. But how was your mind? Like, what did you go through in your mind in terms of discomfort or?
With the cold and flu season here, it's critically important that we enhance and strengthen our immune systems. Yes, would you agree? The problem is, though, that there's so much confusion out there when it comes to what actually works for our bodies and for our health. Well, I'll tell you what I used. I used Maison Beljanski's wellness products. Maison Beljanski's products are backed by science to not only help empower the immune system, but can support detoxification and contribute to our overall health. Coming from Europe, the all-natural Beljanski formulas are now available in the United States and are recommended by top doctors everywhere. A lot of the colleagues I work with, functional medicine practitioners that work with patients with all kinds of diseases, are recommending Maison Beljanski's products to their very own patients. As a special sponsor of this podcast, Maison Beljanski has included a very special discount offer for all of my listeners. You can get 15% off your first order using the promo code Nathan, and you'll always enjoy free shipping when you order four products or more. You can grab your wellness products today at maisonbeljansky.com. That's MAISONBELJANSKI, maisonbeljansky.com, and use code Nathan for 15% off. One of the most important things I've learned over the years in helping many people get and stay healthy is to help them shift their mindset into thinking of themselves as an athlete, no matter their age, whether they just walk 30 minutes a day in the mornings, for example, or they play sports for fun on the weekends, or they go to the gym a couple days a week. No matter what your activity level, if you think of yourself as an athlete, then you start to naturally take better care of your body, focus more on your nutrition, recovery, sleep, other health protocols that optimize your performance as an athlete, and in turn may help you prevent and heal against chronic diseases and help your body be the healthiest that it can possibly be. So if you want to live a long, healthy, vital life and start thinking of yourself as an athlete, head over to plantpoweredathlete.com and get the latest organic, plant-powered protein, super clean, nutrient-dense, high-quality plant-powered protein to help you live your healthiest, most vital life. And you can use our discount code Panacea15 for 15% discount off your first order. Again, that's plantpoweredathlete.com. Get some of the plant-powered protein for yourself and start thinking of yourself as an athlete every day and see how it impacts your health for the long term. All right, let's get to the show. Yeah, in the mind, it was, it was a really interesting experience. And I think partly just because, like, once I was in there, I realized, oh, I'm going to be sitting like this for the next, 10, 12 hours. So it was like a little bit, fear taking over. Like, what is going to happen? Can I lay down? What is, And And then the peyote started kicking in, so I'm kind of seeing stuff and, kind of going through this experience. So I've got this pain going on in the body, and then I've got this mental trip happening, and then paying attention to what the elders are doing and like what's going. I was just trying to be present in the experience, and I could be present and just observe and experience what was happening. And other times, my body would just pull me back in and go, "Oh, this is so uncomfortable," right? I remember at one point, somehow I was sitting in the main chief elder's position, which was at the head of the teepee, and they had been there's a fire in there, and there's a fire keeper, and they'd been creating this with all the ashes. Like, he was constantly working on the fire the whole time and organizing the ashes. And by the end of it, the ashes had made this incredible arrow, beautiful arrow out of all the ashes from the fire that was pointing straight at, where the main tribal elder sat, which is where at some point they had sat me down there. And I was the only person to sit in that place for a while. And then I could feel all that energy coming towards me. It was actually a really crazy experience.
I
It's
bet.
like, I was like, what is going on? It's pretty incredible. But I was also just like trying to observe everybody. Everybody there had been doing these kinds of peyote ceremonies. That was the first and only time I'd ever done peyote, but it was a challenging experience that I'll probably never do again. I can't say I got a ton of, I've done mushrooms before when I was younger, and they definitely helped me spiritually, like tremendously. I've had some psychedelic experiences that have been, very, very helpful for me. But this, I did not feel like I got a big kind of spiritual awakening out of it, other than, man, I gotta take better care of my joints and sit on the floor more often.
Yeah, it was more of an experiential thing that you got out of it.
No, it was actually, I think the biggest takeaway was, look at me, this young, supposed to be healthy, fit guy. I was probably, I don't know, this is 10 years ago, maybe 8 or 10 years ago. And here are these, older 60, 70-year-old guys, and like they are clearly healthier than I am physically. Like, what is going on here? I think it was a big aha moment for me. And that's something that we can, even though people, a lot of the clients I work with go, "Oh, those days are gone." No, we can regain that. Yeah, it's hard work. Yeah, it's not easy. It's not comfortable, but we could regain that mobility through practice. We could regain our vitality through changing our diet and lifestyle, right?
Well, and those elders who were so much, more physically healthy, it's because they've challenged their bodies their whole lives. It's because they've done uncomfortable things. You don't have to be in, mortal pain. But I really do feel like our society's obsession with being comfortable and not ever being in pain, it's really doing us a disservice because I feel like in order, I mean, it's kind of cliche, you have to go through pain to grow, but it is actually really kind of true, because you learn something about yourself and you also learn that a little pain's okay. A little pain is going to get you over there where you want to be, rather than just sitting here comfortable, in front of your screen, laying on the couch, which everyone can do once in a while, that's not where you're going to be able to reach where you want to go. And so I feel like the convenience of convenience foods, the prepackaged processed foods are so convenient. How we treat our bodies, how we just don't move, and moving is tough sometimes. But I really feel like we need to just kind of change our mindset that a little discomfort will actually challenge our bodies to the point where our bodies, our physical bodies, our mental health will become more resilient, than if we just never expose ourselves to discomfort.
What are some of those top, two, three, four things that, when you research ancient cultures, that you think we could learn from them and adapt into our lives that would make us much healthier today?
Well, I think one of the main things is, indigenous ancient cultures have a completely different view about time that we have. They had a very circular view of time. They were confident, that they were provided for, they would always be provided for. The sun always rose the next day. The winter always comes at the same time. But not only that, but as a survival mechanism, they actually needed to be in the present moment. They needed to take care of their bodies because their bodies were their ticket to survival. If they'd mistreated their bodies, they wouldn't survive. We can mistreat our bodies all we want now. I know we have modern medicine to, pull us back from the brink. We might not be having a very healthy, good experience, but we're not going to die. Our survival is not dependent on it. But they needed to be in the present moment for their own bodies, but also for the world around them. If they're out hunting, they needed to be very aware of what's going on. If they're tracking, or maybe if there's someplace where there's dangerous predators, you need to be aware of the sounds and, what's going on around you. And so modern humans, we have a very linear sense of time, and we've learned to never have to spend it in the present moment. We spend it in the past, either regretting or feeling shame, or we're thinking about the future. We're worrying and having anxiety about what may happen rather than inhabiting our bodies now. And so I feel like, that this push for mindfulness and meditation, that kind of has been co going on the last 50 years, is a really good start, because, like I said, we don't need our bodies to survive, but our bodies need us to be healthy. So I think changing kind of how we view time, being more in the present moment, enjoying what we have now rather than thinking about how we need more. Being in the present moment is also being about gratitude, being about what you, appreciating what you have now, rather than, I'll be good when I have this, or I'll be good when I achieve this. So I really think being in the present moment is a really good place to start, because that covers, if you're tired, you go to sleep. You don't stay up and binge watch for 3 more hours. If you're hungry, you eat. If you're not hungry, you don't have to eat. when you're working and you're starting to feel fatigued, you need to take a break. And so being aware of your body in the present moment, I think, will just go a long way.
In yeah, I agree. I love the yogic philosophy on this, which dates back thousands and thousands of years, potentially 10, 20, 30,000. We don't know how many thousands of years
Right.
it goes back, because it's been handed down orally for so many thousands of years before it was ever even written down. But the yogic philosophy, Raja Yoga, for example, I was reading a book by Swami Vivekananda, and he talks about in Raja Yoga how the idea. Today we kind of have this idea that the body is the end. So the whole goal is to be healthy, to get the body healthy, to stay healthy. Like that's the goal, right? Then we'll be happy. So we got to be healthy to be happy. But what the ancient rishis and masters and yogis out of India taught, which was the body is a means to an end. Happiness comes from inside, comes from the soul, comes from our oneness with God, with the creator, with our divine source. That the body, we keep it healthy because it's our vehicle. No other reason than because it's our vehicle. And when the body's healthy, we're not in chronic pain, we're not dealing with disease, we have energy, then we can focus our time and energy spiritually. Which to me, if you look at, you study the ancient Indian cultures, to me, they had this figured out probably better than any ancient culture ever, because they discovered how to be free from the pains and the suffering and the illness of the material world. They learn how to be happy and peaceful and joyful and blissful, even with nothing, with very little food, no special jewels and castles and communities of people. No, did we just cut out there?
Your screen went blank for just a second.
Yeah, that was weird. I saw I go blank in the corner of my eye. And the yogis learn how to find that deep, powerful inner peace and love and bliss that they talk about with nothing. Basically today we would say, you know, oh my gosh, how could you ever be happy and peaceful and blissful with literally nothing? I mean, a blanket, you know,
sleeping on the ground,
clothing, sleeping on the ground and not knowing where your next meal is coming from. Maybe one meal a day, maybe one meal every couple days, didn't matter. It was usually some rice and vegetables and things like that. And yet these are the happiest, most blissful, peaceful people that you would ever meet in your life. And those people still exist today. And most of them come out of India. And it's like, and personally, like that's the path that I'm on, is experiencing that more and more and more and realizing like all this material world, it's like, it doesn't matter how much you acquire, how many gold medals you get, how much money you make, how much fame you have, how many people you help, like all that stuff is fine, but none of it will ever truly make you happy, right? Like you said, living in the present moment, that's step one in the right direction.
Yeah.
Realizing that we have to find that inner peace in the present moment. And I don't know, I can't speak to the minds of many hunter-gatherer communities, like what they thought and believed about. Did they worry about the future? Did they fret on the past? You know, did they were human beings, so I'm guessing they did. They probably worried, you know, when's our next meal going to come? They probably, you know, were concerned about the person they killed that they shouldn't have killed, or losing a family member or whatever it could be. I'm sure those, because they're human beings and everybody has a mind, and the mind's tendency is to jump forward into the future and go backward into the past until we gain control of it through meditation and breath work and, you know, mindfulness, as you mentioned.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, me saying living in the present moment, it's impossible to always live in the present moment. But what I think these ancient cultures, and it's like you said, the yogis could teach us, is you do worry, you do regret, you do, but you know how to return yourself to equilibrium. What's going on now in the modern world is we're constantly in a state of worry. We are constantly in a state of shame and regret, and we don't know how to regulate that and get back to baseline equilibrium. And so the physiological responses that our bodies have to those thoughts, the stress, the cortisol, and, you know, we know now with all the, there's so much research about how much stress just wreaks havoc in our bodies. And so it's not to say that ancient cultures or, you know, our ancient ancestors didn't have those moments. But they really knew how to get back to the equilibrium. They really knew how to maintain homeostasis. And it's because, you know, we talk about in the book, like evolution didn't make us to be happy. Evolution shaped us to be able to like maintain homeostasis and to thrive as best we could in the environment where we were living. And so I think thriving, we use this word eudaimonia, which is kind of a, you know, ancient philosophy kind of word, where it's just like, it's a state of human thriving, you know? And so I feel like everyone's like, oh, I need happiness. I need happiness. But really we need the ability to thrive. We need the ability to be able to do what we want to do with our lives with the vessel that has been given to us. And so I think that is where, yeah, you know, we're thinking happy, 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 when really we need to be at peace with what we have right now. A hunter-gatherer community, an entire community would have more possessions than one early agriculturalist. Like, as soon as we started settling down and farming, that's when we started collecting stuff. There's this book.
Can you say that again?
A single hunter-gatherer tribe would have fewer possessions than one agriculturalist.
Oh, fewer possessions than one person in an agriculture community. An entire tribe would have fewer possessions than one person.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, and, right? That shows you the identity crisis that we have, that we identify ourselves with things, that we need things. We need more things, right, to keep us happy.
I know.
George Carlin
did it. If advertisers had their way, they want us to believe that, for sure.
Well, and that's a big part of the problem, right, is all the freaking advertisements. George Carlin did a great bit. If you haven't seen it, go watch it on YouTube. He talks about, it's called, I think it's called Stuff. Your stuff, my stuff. It's so funny. It's so funny. He's like, and then but I call my stuff stuff. But when I call your stuff is shit. Right? It's like, it's so funny though. It's you gotta go watch it. But
yeah, there's this book written by an anthropologist. His name's Chip Colwell, and it's called So Much Stuff. And it recently came out, I think, the end of last year. But it talks about how we started with nothing, and then how we started to gain stuff, and then how that stuff, we gave that stuff meaning.
Yeah.
And then just the runaway, you know, it's almost an indictment about, you know, we need all this stuff, and yet this stuff is so disposable. Like, we just, you know, when it's no longer serves our purpose, we just throw it out, and it ends up in a landfill or ends up in the oceans.
So let's think through, or maybe you have an idea, or you talk about it in your book, about why the early communities, hunter-gatherer communities, didn't have much stuff, didn't care about much stuff, didn't, I mean, was it they didn't have the skill set to build all the things that later communities were building and utilizing?
I think it really boils down to they were nomadic. They had to carry wherever, you know, they followed the seasons, they followed the animals, they followed where the food was. And so they had to be able to pick up and move on a moment's notice. And so whatever they could carry was on their, you know, whatever they had on their backs. And, you know, that's not to say that maybe they let, you know, they built shelters and they left those shelters behind. So when they went to the new place, they would build new shelters. They would build the things that they needed new that they couldn't carry with them. So I think that's one of it, the nomadic part of it.
What about communities that were near the equator? Because communities that lived near the equator didn't need to be nomadic so much.
They were a little, so there are different kinds of hunter-gatherer societies, and the different kinds of hunter-gatherer societies had different ways of being. The one that I think we've been talking about the most are these nomadic small band hunter-gatherers. There are hunter-gathering groups that are more permanent. They're located around more permanent sources of resources. So like at the mouth of a river where there's so much fresh fish, or so a lot of these societies became a lot more sedentary, and they started to, surprisingly, they started to take on more characteristics that you would think of more as a modern society. They became hierarchical. They became a lot more male dominated. They became, because as soon as there is something to protect, as soon as there's land or resources to protect, these are my resources. Nobody else's resources. These are my resources. Now you have to put things in place to protect those resources. Then that's what happened with the agricultural revolution. So you had this land, and it became, you know, it, someone owned the land, and then the person who owned the land had slaves or servants or serfs or whatever, and they planted the land, and then they had to protect that land for 9 months until they could finally harvest what they, you know, it's this delayed return economy. These small band hunter gatherers, there was no concept of land ownership. They shared everything. It wasn't like, oh, this is mine and that's yours. It's, this is ours. And that was a survival mechanism, because these small band hunter gatherers really needed an intense, way of cooperation, and not competition, because it's all a matter of survival. You know, if you have a band that's in conflict with itself, that band will not survive. So I really feel like, you know, people need to know the difference, that there are different types of hunter-gatherer bands, and each one has different personalities, I guess, characteristics. But the ones that I think that we focus on in the book mostly are these nomadic hunter-gatherers, because for most of our history, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. You know, as things progressed, you know, we became more, you know, a couple of groups became more sedentary, and those are the ones that started farming. You know, that was the evolution of, you know, they realized that they could actually cultivate. You know, they didn't have to just come back to this place where these grains grew. They could actually take the seeds and plant them where they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of all, you know, the evolution of how agriculture happened, it kind of is this natural progression of, okay, this land is fertile. I want this land. This land can, you know, so now that I have this land, I need to protect it. I need people to work it. I need, and that just changed the whole fabric of our civilization.
Yeah, and we still, I think the bigger underlying problem there is the one that we're still seeing today, which you've mentioned previously, is that it's that identity complex, that idea that this is mine and I need to protect this and this is for me and my people, right? And with that's ego. And when I say ego, it's like just that's identity. Identity is the part of our mind that we identify with things because we don't know who we truly are. We don't realize that we are infinite beings, that we have everything we could ever want. We could, you know, we have all the resources that we ever need. And we can share with everybody. In fact, this has been shown in cultures around the world where when people actually come together and go, hey, no, we're going to actually share resources, share ideas, support each other. Everybody's welcome. We help each other. When that is the cultural norm, then everybody actually thrives, right? Those communities thrive. The problem is other people come in and go, oh, these guys aren't protecting their land. They don't have weapons or guns. They think
so
that
we're going to take it from
them. We're going to take it from them, right? And then it creates this, oh, it's mine. No, it's mine. Oh, right. Now we have to protect ourselves. Yeah. And that's all that is a lower level of consciousness, in my opinion. That's we're literally not conscious of the fact that we don't have to be survival of the fittest, right? This whole Darwin, I don't know your take on you know,
Darwinism. Yeah, I think people People have people do not understand what survival of the fittest actually means. Being a fit only means you have survived to reproductive age and you have passed your genes on. It has nothing to do with how good you are or how strong you are. Being fit in terms of Darwin's, survival of the fittest is only that you've passed your genes on. So I feel like people sometimes use survival of the fittest and, oh, it's, you know, it's evolution in a very, very wrong way, in a negative way.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I also understand Darwinism as basically everything's competing against each other for that survival to spread on, to reproduce, right? That everything comes from a competitive philosophy versus a cooperative and collaborative philosophy, which
it
to
totally
me
depends on the species.
Yeah, but I mean, so you could give me some examples, which I'd be interested to hear. But when I look at nature and study nature, actually down to the minutest bacteria, everything's working in collaboration, right? Everything in cooperation. Now, you might say, well, there's invasive species and there's bad bacteria in these, but even they have a purpose. And even, you know, it's like, I still try to understand the purpose for freaking mosquitoes. Like, why? Hate mosquitoes. I
bring
love
that one
every
up too.
Other creature, but not mosquitoes. But I know that they're great food for the fish, you know? So it's like they
the
have a purpose
and...
too, and the birds and all of that,
yeah.
Right? But everything actually, even down to the minutest bacteria, the plant, the everything has a purpose, right? Fungi, oh, it's breaking down things, you know, fungus forms. Yeah, but that's because it's time for that tree or that plant. It needs to be breaking down because it's already unhealthy. And now you're going to bring nutrients to the rest of the plants around it.
Yeah,
like,
everything I think
actually
you bring up a
works
really good
in
point.
Collaboration, cooperation. The only thing, the one thing that doesn't very often is human beings, where, and this is where all our problems come from, is because we think we are competition against each other and not realizing that, oh, when we actually work together, things are better.
Right.
And we do see that around the world, but
yeah,
we also...
I also think, yeah, when you say all of nature has a purpose, we hold ourselves separate from nature. And we talk about this in the nature part of our book, because we are nature. You know, if we didn't have nature, we wouldn't have evolved. We wouldn't have survived.
Right.
We're the only species on the planet that doesn't live in our natural habitat and isn't extinct because of that, though we're trying really hard. So I really think that what you said about having everything be part of this web, humans used to be a part of this web of life, of being able to, and part of being in that web is when everything's, when there's not, you know, big outside things that are happening to it, you know, it's in, it balances out, that life is balanced, you know, the things that grow are balanced by the things that break down. So I feel like there's this balance, and I feel like our ancestors and indigenous cultures really understood this about nature and our role in nature. Our ancestors aren't tree huggers, but because they realized that they needed to take care of the environment, and they needed to understand all of these different forces that are going on because their survival depended on it. And so being stewards of the land, and understanding the human being's role in that web of life, it is so critical. And I think we need to look to those cultures to teach us and lead the way back to that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's something, one of the big things that we can learn from our indigenous ancestors is that reverence. If I've spent a lot of time with different tribes over the years, for the last almost 18 plus years, Lakota and Hopi, and doing ceremonies and sweat lodges and learning from them. And it's, I've learned so much from these indigenous cultures. And the one thing that so many of them still hold as part of their culture is that reverence for the planet, right? Pachamama, Mother Earth. It's like, this is our mother. This gives us our life. This sustains our life, this planet. And so, how can we destroy this planet that sustains us? How can we treat it so poorly? How can we, it's like your own parents, taking care of you, giving you food, clothing, taking you to school, helping raise you. And then, every day you're cutting them, you're hurting them, you're kicking them, you're harming them, you're yelling at
Poisoning
them,
them.
poisoning them, right? Which, I mean, unfortunately, kids, we do that in different ways to our
Right,
parents, unconsciously.
unknowingly.
Yes, I certainly did, unfortunately. And I've had to ask for a lot of forgiveness for my childhood, I'll tell you that much. But recognizing that this planet is essential for our life and for our well-being, and starting to, it's just a shift in consciousness to go, oh, okay, maybe I'll make better decisions, right? Maybe I'll use less plastic. Maybe I'll do things that are less toxic. Maybe I will try to grow some food. Maybe I will support local farmers, right? Maybe I will just start to take better actions that are in alignment with that philosophy. And if everybody does that, even at a small level, I think we would see a huge shift in the right direction.
And I think every small action that you take, you see the results of it, and it makes it easier to take the next action. It's kind of this snowball effect. There was something that you said earlier that made me think, well, and also the nature thing. So you were talking about these peoples who worked together and, they were thriving, and then this outside influence would come in, right? And say, well, for instance, like colonists who come to Africa, they're like, you are savages, you have nothing, you are poor. What's interesting is there are a lot of discussions about how childlike and playful these groups are. And so they actually, but they were saying that in a negative way. Like, we have to come save you from yourselves.
Right.
And that, like you said, the arrogance of that. But then not only do you change their way of life, but you remove them from the land because you want the land. And then if you watch what happens to those people who have been completely alienated from everything they've ever known, the speed at which the diseases of modernity come in, for instance, like I can think of like the Pima culture in the Southwest. When they were overtaken by modern society, they now have like 75% of the people over 30 or something crazy like that have type 2 diabetes
Yeah.
because they were just cut off from how they used to live and they were forced to live this way. And we can see what happens to them. And what's interesting is what happens to these groups are a microcosm of what's happened to us over the last 12,000 years when we started, when we moved away from our homes, when we started changing how we lived. It took a really, really long time for all of these effects to start showing up. But effectively, what we've done to ourselves as a society is what people are doing to these indigenous groups, cutting them off from their way of life and moving them from the land, and then watching what happens. It's no wonder that where we are right now is, we're in such a plight of survival, of health, of wellness, of cooperation, of you know, there's lots of violence, and you know, there's just all this stuff going on, and it's because we're not living the way we used to live. And not, that's not to say, I mean, human beings, like you said, we have ups and downs, and we have violent tendencies, and we have cooperative tendencies, and but always in a sense of equilibrium. But right now there's no way to return to that equilibrium until we start returning to what our bodies and our minds actually need, and how that's how we evolve to live.
What our bodies and minds actually need. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that. I also want to just, what as I studied indigenous cultures over the years as well, the unfortunate reality is there were very violent indigenous cultures as well, right? So yes,
Oh
the
yeah.
atrocities that happened to the tribes in Africa, in South America, in North America, whether it's from Europeans, it was from, every culture has been enslaved and mutilated and had brutal experiences from every other culture, just about, right? We often think of, slavery and, being pretty much European based on, African people or South American or even North American. But it's actually, Native American tribes have enslaved each other. Africans have enslaved each other, right? Mesoamerica, tribes have killed each other and slaughtered each other. It's been a unfortunate reality of the human condition, of this separateness that we're talking about, of this mind false idea, thinking that, oh, this is mine and we are different, and so I have to take from you because I don't have enough for me. When in reality, there's so much abundance for everybody. We can
Exactly.
clearly see that now, especially. And I go to places like Northern Kenya, Turkana, to go bring seeds and tools to the tribes who are literally starving to death today in Northern Africa. Actually, in many places around Africa, but here, I'm meeting women who are 60 years old who get to eat one or two meals a month,
Oh
and
my
they're
goodness.
skin and bones, and their meal is like corn. They get like some corn, maybe some peas with that.
Wow. And then you go into our grocery stores and you're just like, there's so much food, they throw it out.
Infinite.
When,
It's just infinite. I mean, in here in the US, people go, well, yeah, people are starving to death here in the US. Yes, that is a sad thing. But not necessarily starving to death, not that I've seen. You can be homeless and still eat one or two meals every single day. You just go to the dumpsters, right, behind a restaurant where they throw out literally fresh food every day. We see that. You don't see very many, homeless people who are skin and bones unless they're really on drugs and alcohol. I mean, actually, I see a lot of homeless people who are overweight because they eat too much of this processed food that we
Or the
just throw
crap.
away. I'm not saying it's better one way or the other. I'm just saying that we still live today where tribes in parts of the world are literally starving to death because they don't have enough food. And yet, some of these people were some of the happiest people I've ever met in my life. They were so happy and dancing. We were dancing with them, and they were, smiling and laughing and so grateful to get a single bag of seeds to go plant some crops, And there's a lot of reasons for what's going on there. But at the same time, it's oftentimes that's why I say we romanticize. I'll speak about myself. I used to romanticize our ancient cultures, I think, a little too extreme, where I used to believe like we need to live the way our ancestors lived. Like I used to have that belief so strongly. But then I realized, well, yeah, they all did all the same terrible stuff that we do to each other now, just with less technology. But they did the same stuff,
Well, and
so.
also, this is another really big point. When we lived as hunter-gatherers, the entire planet was occupied by the population of like Cairo, like the whole planet. So the agricultural revolution, I mean, when we started the population growth, that is when, the becoming more violent for resources, because now we have more people to feed every year, more and more and more and more people to feed. And so our population growth has made it so it's completely impossible for us to go back and live that way anyway. So what can we integrate together? What can we integrate? And like we said before, there's some amazing things about the modern world. But I don't think we have the mindset to appreciate those things because the modern world also has all of these negative things that are so we're so latched onto or addicted to, or it takes us away from being in the present moment. It takes us it helps us become more individualized, more egocentric, more like, individualism is where it's at. So yeah, I feel like as romantic as it sounds, and it might be really fun to go camping for a week, you don't want to you
Which I love doing.
oh yeah, which is awesome, but you get to go
Right.
back home,
Yeah,
and
exactly.
so I really think people need to remember that, it is an integration. We have to reintegrate and figure out how it fits into this modern world.
And what are some more ways that we can integrate some of the good things, the good qualities of our
Yeah,
ancestors
well, I mean,
into the
so
modern
for
world?
instance, sleep.
Yeah.
Our ancestors and hunter-gatherers who were studied into the present moment, they didn't actually sleep longer than us. They had very similar periods of sleep, but they were very entrained with their circadian rhythms to the cycles of light and dark on the earth. So because they were outside all the time, when they woke up in the mornings, they had very bright light. And when the sun went down, they didn't have any light. And so every single morning, their circadian rhythms were reset. And your circadian rhythms control so many things, your metabolism, your hormone production. Almost every single aspect of the human body is controlled by these circadian rhythms. And so our ancestors would have the sun and they'd reset every day. And then the sun went down. Their circadian rhythms, would do the things they needed to do to go to sleep and then wake up naturally, and then the sun would reset. And so now we wake up and we're inside our houses, temperature controlled, light controlled. We have this kind of twilight existence where, we have screens and we have fluorescent lights, and so we're never like exposed to this really bright light in the morning that resets our circadian rhythms. And then, of course, when the sun goes down, we still have light bombarding us from all sides. Our bodies don't know what to do, when to start, when to end. And so circadian mismatch is the root cause of a lot of these diseases of modernity. Cancer, because cell cycle, the cell cycle is dictated by circadian rhythms. And if your circadian rhythms are all out of whack, your cell cycling is out of whack. So that's just like one thing. Like, we can get bright light in the morning and we can decrease our light. Some people call light a pollutant. It's polluting our worlds. And so that's a simple way we can consciously get outside in the morning, get bright light, really be conscious of the light that we have after the sun goes down. All of our devices have these shifts where you can go to red shift or night shift, or because the circadian rhythms are very exquisitely attuned to blue light, the blue wavelength of light, because that's the wavelength of light that penetrated deeper into the oceans where life began. So that, I mean, even the very first cells of life had circadian rhythms. So that's one of the examples of like this continuum from way, way back into now of something that we still need to be aware of that still control our body systems that we actually have control of. We just didn't know that we needed to make sure we controlled that.
It's really actually a very important topic, and one of the reasons that I swapped out years ago most of the bulbs in our house for blue light blocking bulbs. So they're like they put out an orange glow. So when we turn on lights at night, we still have light, but it's a fraction of the intensity. It's an orange glow. It doesn't
It's like
have the blue
firelight
light.
almost. Yeah,
Yeah, it
it's
doesn't have the blue light.
more mimicking blue firelight at night.
I read by candlelight at night in my bed
Oh,
instead of the
nice.
lamp as well, right? I have a blue light blocking bulb there, but I recognize that even candle is even better than that. It's interesting because like street lights, will mess up your circadian rhythm. So making sure that you don't have any light coming from outside in your windows. So we have, completely blackout shades. I saw a study that even they took one LED light and put it under the cover, so your eyes couldn't technically even see it. And just having a single light under the covers, where your body was sensing it, was messing up circadian rhythm. So, you know, leaving lights on in the room at all, night lights, any light at all, aside from like candlelight and moonlight. Moonlight actually doesn't affect the circadian rhythm in a negative way, from the research I've seen. So moonlight coming in through the windows is actually fine, but and candlelight is fine, but any other light at all you want to turn off completely. So you should be generally in a totally blacked out room. You know, blue light blocking bulbs. I have the glasses. I just don't like wearing glasses in the evening. So that's why I changed out all the bulbs in the house. But blue light blocking that's glasses smart. Can help as well.
Yeah, since I already wear glasses all day, it doesn't bother me
yeah,
to have
it's easy,
those.
It's easy for you, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're used to it.
I'm totally used to it.
And that might be easier for most people than swapping out all your bulbs for, you know, blue light blocking bulbs. But
well, but then if you swap out all your bulbs, you're not only, you know, taking care of yourself, but everyone in your family is getting the same
yes
experience too.
Yeah,
and we
exactly.
Don't have, yeah.
And I do, and my kids don't, you know, they don't care one way or the other, but I do care for them. So
exactly. So exactly. Well, and their eyes, they're like, if they get used to that, I mean, every day I have, you know, at 4 o'clock, I have all my devices shift.
Yep.
And if I'm looking at a screen while it's happening, I'm like, oh, that's weird. But literally your eyes, like 30 seconds later, I can't even tell the difference.
Yep.
It's amazing. Your brain can like make those changes.
Yeah.
So
it's like
yeah.
instantly. It's very fast. It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. I have night shift. That's a great, I'm glad you mentioned that night shift on the phone, you know, so it darkens at sunset and gets darker and darker as the time goes on, or oranger and oranger, whatever setting you have. And then the mornings. Yeah. It's like, I turn on the bright lights. My wife and I do our meditation 6 a.m. in the morning. And then you know, we'll turn on the bright light. And then when the sun comes up, if it's a sunny day, like I run the dogs around the block. So I'm outside getting that sunlight right in the eyes.
Well, and you're outside, so you're getting the benefits of nature. You're getting the benefits of movement. I mean, I think getting out in the morning and I walk the dogs. But getting out into nature in the morning, it has so many benefits, not just circadian rhythms, but the benefits of nature and the benefits of movement.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, aside from all the research we have on this so far, which is a lot that shows the benefits of everything we're talking about, it's the way that we're designed. As you said, we're designed to be in nature, part of nature, living in nature. We're not designed to be in these, you know, square boxes blocked off from nature 24/7.
Right.
You know, that's not what and that's why we're getting so unhealthy. We're, you know, so many diseases. We have disconnected ourselves from nature. And the closer and closer we get back to nature, the less and less disease we're going to have. And I'm talking diet, lifestyle, you know, toxic exposure, all these things, stress, you know, the more time you spend in nature too, the less stress you have. And that's why the Japanese have coined something called forest bathing, knowing you know that when you go out and you go for a hike out in the woods, you literally feel better. Why? You're getting all these negatively charged ions. You're getting all this energy from the nature. You're getting all, you know, relaxation, less intensity.
I also feel like nature instills in people a sense of humility because there's so many things in nature that inspire awe. I really think that more people spending time in nature will really start helping that whole individual, you know, ego, mind problem. Because I mean, there have been studies showing that nature does, you know, instill humility in people. When people are out in nature, when they come back, you know, to their normal lives, they feel more altruistic, they feel more gratitude, they feel, and I mean, then that's not an accident, you know, it's because that's where our senses, you know, evolved. We were in nature. We feel comfortable in nature. It feels right when you're out in nature. You're just like, oh, finally I can relax. I can be what I'm meant to be. Just like being, just sitting there in nature. I've had that experience so many times.
It's so true. It's so powerful. Well, Jenny, it's been awesome talking to you. I know we could probably talk for another hour or two just on nature alone.
Oh yeah, get me started on nature. Don't get me started.
So spend more time in nature, folks. Whatever you can do, whatever.
Yeah,
you can
that
do.
If this is the only thing you get from listening to this, go outside.
Yeah, Jenny, where can people get your book and get in touch with you?
Well, we have our website, www.ontheoriginofbeing.com. There's a link there to get our book. It's also wherever online book retailers are sold. So Barnes and Noble and Amazon and places like that. I am on Instagram. I, kind of just got back into social media for the book. And so I spent Instagram's probably my favorite platform. I'm at On the Origin of Being. And there's also, the places to contact us on the website. You can join our newsletter. I've been on podcasts here and there, and we're actually just starting work on the next book. So hopefully a year from now, that second book will come out.
Awesome. Well, maybe we'll have you back on the next year
Oh,
when the
that'd be
book comes
great.
out. We could talk about book two.
Exactly. There's a lot of fodder there too.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Jenny. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Nathan Crane Podcast. Please make sure to subscribe and share this on social media. Then head over to nathancrane.com for your free ebook.
So when we're talking about, what are these underlying causes and conditions of these chronic diseases, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, they all have very similar, if not identical, causes. And that's the thing, is when we get to the root cause of these diseases, we can not only prevent these diseases from ever happening, but empower our bodies to heal from them.
In every one of our cells, we have tens and hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions that are happening every second that are cycling back and forth. And it's like sort of a yin and yang.
And, for me, the soul's purpose is evolution. It doesn't care about comfort. It cares about evolution. And so I think so long as we are following our soul, then we will evolve. And I think what sometimes blocks us from living our purpose, from manifesting that next level of our expression, is we have not evolved.
There is also a time for letting go all the expectations and relax and just breathe and be grateful for what you have achieved.